Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Beautiful Legacy Podcast. I am your host, Abigail Gagnon, and today we have a special guest, Emily Ward. She is a good friend of mine, and we met in a similar way that Tim and I did, that Hannah and I did. For anyone that's listened to the 365 days episode or the grief episode, but I believe that Emily and I weren't on the forums at the same time, or we at least didn't really talk, I don't think, but we did meet through a Facebook group that connected a lot of us that were on the forums. So we kind of met on there, but kind of didn't at the same time. Emily, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, thanks, first of all, for having me on here. And yeah, I think we just missed each other on those forums. I think I'm older by just a couple years, but basically I am based out of Kentucky and I'm a mother of two and married to my elementary sweetheart. We met each other in fifth grade. I do writing as well as dabble a little bit in homemaking, like making sourdough bread and all that kind of stuff. And I'm a stay-at-home mom, but I dabble in a lot of different areas. But yeah, mostly being a mom, that's my big focus right now, just because my kids are really little.
That's awesome. And did you always want to be a mom?
I think I did. I don't know if it was something I actually thought of. I remember when my husband and I were dating, I told him that I loved helping people become the best versions of themselves and how I like to nurture. And he said, "It sounds like you want to be a mom." And I was like, "Oh, you know, that does sound like I want to be a mom." And I had never actually thought about it that way. I had always just thought I like helping people. But the level that I like to help people is like a depth that you can only really get as a mother. So
that's really interesting. I don't think I've ever had someone tell me that they like wanted to be a mom, but they didn't realize that they wanted to be a mom. So that's really interesting. And, obviously this episode, well, you and I both know that a lot of what we're going to be talking about is Elliot today. So when did you find out that he had Down syndrome?
Well, it was really a surprise for all of us. Just for some background, my dad has a disability, but he's got epilepsy. So I had always been used to accommodating my life around somebody with a disability, but he doesn't have any developmental disabilities, which Down syndrome is a little different where it affects like the muscles and affects his processing and just when he reaches his milestones. So my son Elliot, typically you can see that kind of stuff on the ultrasound, but we didn't see anything because he didn't have a heart issue. He didn't have any significant factors where you could tell that he had it in the womb. And I didn't have any genetic testing because we didn't have a history of Down syndrome. So it was pretty much as soon as I started having complications at week 35 of the pregnancy, they rushed me to the hospital, induced me. I had my baby and they put him in my arms and was like, "It looks like he has Down syndrome." And that was like, it was 2 seconds after I had my baby when I found out.
That is crazy. That must have been really hard to process after having just given birth, that being your first one.
Yes, it was very scary at first, especially for my husband, because he doesn't have a history of any disabilities in his family. And I could see the light literally went out of his eyes. Like as soon as the doctor said that, like I was riding on the hormones, you know, I had like the oxytocin and all that stuff. You know, I was still just like, "It's my baby." But I could tell that he was just like, "What is this going to mean? Is my son, you know, not going to survive? Like, does he have health issues? Like, what's going to happen?" And like, it was very hard, especially because we were in the middle of a pandemic and because he was born smack in the middle of 2020. And we were like, is he going to get really sick? And so because he had to be in the NICU for like about 3.5 weeks after he was born.
That would be really scary. I know having a kid in the NICU to start with would be really hard. I have a cousin that works with babies in the NICU, and it just people that work there, it's hard for them, let alone the parents. So I can't imagine dealing with that, trying to figure out more about like his diagnosis, and then like also having to deal with the pandemic stuff as well. That would be a lot all at once.
Yeah, it was definitely a challenge because we couldn't go to anybody else and ask them, hey, have you been through this? Because it was like, yes, there was people who'd been through Down syndrome and those diagnoses and like have had it affect their family, but they've not had it happen during a pandemic. That was one of those things that was like an extra layer of things where it's like, well, we're the first ones going through this, you know? And it was hard too, because our local Down syndrome organization had just started a medical outreach, program. And we were the first people that they were reaching out to. So they hadn't ever done this before. So it was just a totally new thing for everybody. So we felt like we were just kind of on an island by ourselves during that time.
That definitely sounds like that would be the way that you would feel, and very valid. And for those listening, I know I probably should have asked this first. For those listening that don't know what Down syndrome is, can you tell us a little bit about that? Are there different types, or is it just, you know, if you have Down syndrome, you have Down syndrome and that's it, with different, like maybe degrees?
So I will do my best to explain it like the medical way, but I'm not a doctor. I'll give that disclaimer. But I know that I might explain it a little bad, but so Down syndrome also goes by trisomy 21. And that's because the child, when they are conceived, like the second they're conceived, they have an extra chromosome in their DNA. So that extra chromosome affects everything in their development. So there are plenty of children, of course, in the modern times who have Down syndrome who, you know, it's a viable pregnancy and they're born healthy and happy. But there are a lot of them that have issues, like it'll show up as like heart issues, and some of them develop epilepsy. Some of them will have different health issues because having that extra chromosome throws off a lot of the typical development that a child goes through. But majority of kids with Down syndrome, they all have low muscle tone. They have kind of those almond-shaped eyes that most people kind of associate with Down syndrome. They have what's called sandal gap, which is where their big toe is like separates from the other toes to where it looks like they've got, you know, like flip-flops on constantly. Is the best way to explain it. And then they also have where there's like a crease on their hand. There's only one crease instead of two, like most people. I think another thing is their ears are lower on their head. So they're not like centered. They're more lower on the side of their head. So there's different like physical manifestations where people can tell right away if they have Down syndrome. But one thing I didn't know is that they look a whole lot more like their family than they do other kids with Down syndrome. I thought that all kids with Down syndrome looked the same. And I was mistaken, because they don't. They have similar characteristics, but they look a lot more like their family than they do just all like a monolith of the same person, you know. But that's the main thing. And it does affect the muscle tone is the main thing that affects like their abilities to like they don't walk as quickly as other kids. They don't speak as quickly as other kids. A lot of their milestones, if it takes one kid a year to do something, it'll take a kid with Down syndrome usually 2 years. So it's usually twice as long for them to develop. So I think that explains most of it. But if you have questions about any of that, let me know.
No, that's really interesting. I feel like some of that I knew, but I had no idea about the toe thing. That's really interesting. And also, I mean, I guess it makes sense about the children looking more like their family than necessarily just another child or person with Down syndrome. But I never would have thought about that. But I also haven't seen like a ton of people that have Down syndrome, like comparing them. Like I haven't like specifically looked for that, like, oh, they're in a group with Down syndrome, you know, other people with Down syndrome, but they also then like seeing them with their family. And I don't know, I've never thought about that. That's really interesting.
Well, and it definitely like One thing I did forget to mention is that they, unlike autism, which is on a spectrum, Down syndrome is usually just like, you just have Down syndrome. So like, there's three different kinds, but it's like, there's just trisomy 21, regular Down syndrome that most people have, most kids with Down syndrome have. There's, I can't remember the name of it, but it's a Down syndrome that's genetically passed on. So the parents have like a genetic marker where their kids are just going to all have Down syndrome more than likely. That's a very rare case. And then there's another one, which is mosaic Down syndrome, which is where they have a lot of the physical aspects of Down syndrome, like internally, like their development and maybe their health, but physically they don't have the characteristics. So they look like somebody that, you know, just a traditional child, and then, but then they have like a lot of the developmental things that come along with Down syndrome. So, but those are the three different kinds, but basically it's like you either have it or you don't have it, unlike autism where it's kind of on a spectrum of how severe it is.
That's really interesting. And with, I know that you found out after he was born, but do you know if you had found out earlier, if there were things that they would have wanted you to do different during your pregnancy? Not that that would have necessarily changed the diagnosis, but maybe been beneficial to his development or anything like that. I have no idea if that's something that would even make a difference.
I know for my case, like whenever I started having issues at week 35, I was having some issues with my placenta, which the placenta also gets an extra chromosome if your child has Down syndrome, because the placenta is created, you know, when you have, when you're, the baby is conceived. So there were a lot of issues with my placenta that they might have been able to kind of keep an eye on if they knew, you know. Now they wouldn't have been able to do anything about it. Like the placenta, if it was going to mess up, it was just going to do that. They couldn't prevent that, but they could at least have been watching me earlier, you know, been tracking and making sure that I was okay. And because I was a like no risk pregnancy. Like when I first got pregnant, they're like, well, you're totally fine. You're healthy. Like there's no big issues. And, but in that case, like they might've been monitoring me more closely if they had known. Mm-hmm. I know for some people, it's a controversial thing, because I know personally I'm very pro-life and I support, you know, having your baby regardless of the diagnosis. But like, I know that there are some that choose to terminate the pregnancy if they get a pre-birth diagnosis. So I know that that's a hot button issue in the disability community, but I feel like that's the only other thing that I've heard of people, you know, bringing up if they get like a pre-birth, you know, diagnosis. But otherwise it's really not anything you can do except just to monitor it and make sure that the baby is healthy until the baby is born. So which especially if they have a heart issue, that's a main thing. Like he didn't have a heart issue, so that was something that we didn't have to worry about.
That makes complete sense. And I know that you touched on it a little bit, but how has navigating finding out about that and different challenges that you'd face, like how have you dealt with that? What are different things that you've done, different, you know, resources or support systems that you found?
The main thing was humanizing the experience for other people has helped me a lot. I personally grew up in a family where we were not allowed to really talk much about disability, and because my family was very private, and I respect that, and I respect my dad not wanting us to be just, you know, broadcasting his disability for everybody. But at the same time, it did make it harder for me to understand what other people were going through, because I couldn't talk to other people about it. So when we had Elliot, my goal was to bridge the gap between people who are compassionate but don't understand what you're going through, and then people who have a child with a disability. So teaching other people about it has really helped heal that part of me a little bit, and has helped me understand other people a little bit better. So that was the main thing, is trying to connect with other people about it. But on a more practical angle, we looked into, we have a local Down syndrome organization that we support and that we take part in. And then we also have several people at our church community that are either doctors or they're people who have kids with Down syndrome that we connect with. And that has been hugely important to just have those connections and then to really become close with all of Elliot's doctors and his therapists and just all of those support systems.
That's really awesome. I'm so glad that you have that. And I know that we have talked about this, but how have you found that you or Elliot being treated differently due to his Down syndrome? Like, how has that impacted you mentally and emotionally?
I think it's been interesting because majority of the time, people do not mean to be offensive. Majority mm-hmm. of the time, everybody is very kind and they do their best to be kind. I think some of the things that have hurt my feelings have just been accidental. I've never had anybody who's just kind of come up to me and been like, hey, I think your kid is dumb. You know, like there's not anybody mm-hmm. who's been that mean, you know. I think majority of the time, if I had had like a bigger following or something on Facebook or Instagram, or I might deal with trolls because I've seen a lot of people who have more of a reach than I do deal with people who are just very rude. But at least on the day-to-day basis, it's just more of like careless comments. I remember I had a very sweet older lady come to me and tell me how beautiful my child was. And she said, he's going to be super tall. And he just looks like he's going to be really tall. Well, one of the things with Down syndrome is that they're not tall. They generally are very short. And I explained to her, I said, oh, well, he's got Down syndrome and he's going to be on the smaller side. And she goes, oh, he doesn't look like he has Down syndrome at all. He looks really smart. And I know she didn't mean it in an offensive way, but it was one of those moments where you're like, well, I never said anything about how smart he was, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's things like that, that I feel like you just got to kind of pick your battles. You know, it was a moment where I'm like, I'm not going to correct her or anything. Cause I know she didn't know what to say. So, but yeah, I don't know if I might've gone on a rabbit trail there, but I know that I was like, mostly how it's affected me is I've had more community behind me rather than people who have torn me down. You know, mm-hmm. I think I've had so much more support, since going through this.
That's really awesome. I'm so glad you have that. And with that, is there things that you've heard multiple times that are along those lines of like, they're not meaning it in a bad way, but that you would suggest that people don't say to somebody who has a kid with Down syndrome or to someone who has Down syndrome? Or has there not been like a consistent pattern of things that people have said that you are like, yeah, people need to stop saying that?
I think one thing that's been controversial, I think, for me is realizing that when people say, oh, all kids are just totally different, and like my nephew didn't walk until he was like one, or my nephew didn't walk until, I understand that people are trying to relate to me on a human level, but I found that it actually makes me feel worse. And I'm going to give some background because it sounds like, you know, like that wouldn't, you know, be a bad thing. But I think a lot of times when you say stuff like, oh yeah, my son's not doing that yet, or my son can't talk yet and he's 3.5, or people try to find common ground. But I think I appreciate when people just make space for me and they make that space for me to be upset and to grieve. And they just say, that must be really hard. Instead of trying to be like, my kid who doesn't have a disability didn't talk until he was 1 year old. And that's like, well, that's actually really early. Like, I know you're trying to be like my buddy on this, but at the same time, not all kids are the same. And it's okay that my kid is really different than your kid. And it's okay to accept that. It's okay to be like, yeah, that sounds like that's really hard. What can I do to support you? Because I'm not mad at your kid for being able to talk when they're supposed to talk, you know. It's just one of those things where I feel like a lot of people, they'll be like, oh man, you know, all kids are different. And I'm like, it's true, but my kid is drastically different than your kid, and that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that you mentioning grief, I think, is really important, because I think that sometimes it's so easy to think about just grief of like somebody dying. And I think that grief can be for so many things, like grieving someone that's alive but isn't in your life anymore, or grieving somebody, you know, that you thought was one way but you found that they're completely the opposite, or grieving hopes and dreams that you had for yourself or for your child. And I think that that is something that needs to be talked about more.
Yeah, I think that that's something I didn't realize until having Elliot, is that I was grieving my expectations for my life. Because, and I don't know if you've had this as like a past homeschooler experience, but when I was homeschooled as a kid, I remember my mom and dad, like, they would sometimes sit down, we'd have like really deep discussions about our schoolwork. Like, we'd talk about history, or we'd talk about literature, or we'd talk about, you know, theology. And like, it was part of our schooling, but it was also part of our, like, we kind of were intellectuals. We like to talk about that kind of stuff. And like, I guess I thought when I had kids, they were going to be big readers and they were going to like to do all that kind of stuff. And when we had Elliot, I remember feeling, well, what if he's never able to read? Or what if he doesn't know how to have a conversation with me? Or what if, you know, he doesn't ever go to like college, or he doesn't go, or what if I can't homeschool him because he's, you know, has a lot of challenges. And so it was a moment of me realizing, like, I had kind of put this on a pedestal of thinking like, oh, my kids are going to all be like book smart, and realizing that Elliot's going to be smart in different ways, and that's okay. So it's hard to like grieve that and to kind of bring yourself off that and be like, it's okay. God is teaching me a new way that I never knew before.
Yes, exactly. And I think sometimes it's so hard when you're grieving something, like someone that isn't dead, and it's like either something or someone that's alive, because I feel like it's a lot easier to, you know, if someone asks, you know, like, oh, you seem really sad, to say that you're grieving someone that's, you know, not here anymore, than if you're talking about grieving something else. Like, for me, like grieving not being able to do the things that I want to do physically because of my chronic illness. And it's sometimes hard to be like, okay, well, I'm also grateful that I can do more than I used to be able to do. And I'm grateful that I can walk. I'm grateful I can use my arms and whatever. But I feel like two things can coexist at the same time.
Yes. Well, and that's a huge thing that, you know, I didn't realize that you could be grieving, you know, the child that you expected to have while also celebrating who he is. Cause like, it felt sort of like a betrayal. Like, I was betraying my son, you know, like, oh, to be upset about this is like, I'm not supporting him. But it's okay to kind of grieve that. Cause I think, you know, I can say that other parents go through that. That's not a rare thing to go through. Cause I know a lot of parents have that moment where, let's say, their kids grow up and they start hanging out with a bad crowd, or maybe they start straying from the faith that they were raised on, or, you know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff where the parents grieve what they expected their children to be. But I think it's like, you don't expect that to happen until they're teenagers. So it feels weird to go through it now where I'm like, he's only 3 and a half, you know?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I know that you had talked about some like local resources that you had and different people in your community, but do you know of any resources that are either maybe virtual or like nationwide that you maybe could recommend to people that also have children with Down syndrome?
So I know that there's several different organizations that I was connected to whenever we first got started. So there's the Down Syndrome Diagnosis Network, and so DSDN. They are a huge organization that connects people. So they have all different kinds of groups. they've got like, you know, a Down syndrome group for dads and a Down syndrome group for moms. And then they've got a crunchy parenting Down syndrome group for people who are into the more natural remedies and stuff. And they've got a Down syndrome / autism group, which we recently actually just in the last year got a diagnosis for autism for Elliot as well. So that's a group that I recently joined because I was like, well, this is a new thing I don't know anything about. So so that's been extremely helpful to have that on top of it. And then I know with each state, I'm sure they have their own organizations. I know for ours is very like county based, so it's like a county that in Kentucky, that's where we base most of our Down syndrome stuff out of. So but yeah, I think a lot of them, that's the main one that I would connect people to. And then I would also say Instagram. Go on Instagram and just start looking up Down syndrome. You're going to find so many people who share about their kids and share about their victories and their struggles. And that's where I found a lot of like individuals that have really helped me out.
That's really awesome. I think that social media can be such like not a very good thing in many ways, but it also can be such a blessing, and you can meet so many amazing people through social media that I think sometimes people that don't know how to utilize it properly, oh my gosh, or are afraid to like just reach out to people that they don't know, they're missing out on such a big opportunity to meet some amazing people that they can connect with on similar levels or just learn about different things.
Well, and it helps so much with like, you know, when I first got Elliot's diagnosis, I didn't want anyone to talk to me. I had so many people who were like, oh, I have all these people that you can talk to. And I was just like, I didn't want them to bother me. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I just was in a bad headspace. But it helped to be able to get on Instagram and see like, kind of just quietly follow people and see like, oh, there's their kid and they're living their life and they're happy. And they're, because I think I had just this feeling like, he's not going to be happy. He's going to be unhealthy. And like, I'm not going to know how to take care of him. And, but it helped so much to see people who had already been there to show their kids and be like, this is my kid. He's like 22 and he's a photographer now and he does all these cool things. And you're like, wow, that's really awesome. So it kind of helped me get through that dark period when, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen.
That's really awesome. And I know that you, I believe that you got all this sorted out to be able to be his caretaker and get paid for it. Is that correct? Remember, yes. Remember correctly. And yeah. How was that process like? Like, is that, was that an easy thing? I can't remember what you told me the process was like for that.
So it was definitely one of the more stressful things I've ever had to do. but I think that's inherently anything with the government, I feel like is just stressful. But I know at least in Kentucky, they have a program. It's called the Medicaid waiver program. And then there's also the Michelle P waiver program. And I applied for both, but like the Michelle P waiver, there's like an 11-year wait list or something. So we're on the wait list. But basically the Medicaid waiver program, we had to go through a process of, first of all, applying for Medicaid, and then, which is like an insurance basically through the state. And then we had to apply for me to be his like caregiver, because I quit my job to stay home with him. And so like, of course, my husband's the only one working right now, so we were missing that income. But what's really helpful is that applying to be his caregiver and going through that process, while it took a long time, it's helped a lot because it's given us that extra income and covered most of his medical bills and all that, which he does have quite a lot of medical bills. So, but that was very helpful to do that. I think it was mostly just trying to do the paperwork. They have you fill out so many things like, you know, his medical records and fill out, financial records and how many people are living in the house and, you know, all those kind of things. And it's just like, they pretty much want to know everything about you. So you're filling out paperwork for hours.
That I feel like is anything to do with government stuff. Like when we do our insurance, we get like a normal health insurance plan, like not Medicaid or Medicare, but we go through the government system to get help with the insurance costs because of me not being able to work. And it just was so much, like so many questions. It's like, why, how does this apply to health insurance? But I guess we'll answer it. So yeah, stuff with the government can definitely be really extensive when it comes to that. And with his diagnosis, how did that change how you felt during your second pregnancy versus your first?
It definitely put a lot more fear, I think, in the pregnancy and a lot more, I don't know, just a lot more nerves, because when you have a child with Down syndrome, when that's your first child, the doctors treat you like you're high risk all the time. Mm-hmm. That's one of those things that was like surprising to me, because when I got pregnant the second time, I just kind of thought like, well, I already had a child with Down syndrome and the likelihood of having another one is very low. So they're just going to treat me, you know, normal. And it was like, no, that's not what's going to happen. Like they monitored me constantly and I still had a high risk pregnancy and I still had issues with my placenta in my second pregnancy. So it was a good thing that they were watching me anyway. But it was one of those things that I remember feeling so nervous that something was going to happen. And I went and had the genetic testing just to be safe. And I just felt like I had several doctors watching me. And one of them, she wanted me to get all the testing. And the other doctor was like, no, you don't have to do that. So I was getting so much conflicting information too, where it's like some people were extra cautious. And then there's other people that were like, it's okay, you don't have to do that. So I felt like I had to do a lot of my own research and a lot of my own discernment on a lot of that, just because I felt like some doctors just weren't sure what to do with me. They were like, well, you had issues with your first one, so we don't know what to do with this one.
Yeah, that would be really hard. And I think that kind of can play into like advocating for yourself in general, because I feel like oftentimes doctors will try to recommend like a lot of things, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do those testings. Obviously when you're pregnant it's a little bit different, of you probably want to err on the side of caution, but I think sometimes people don't realize that they can say no to certain testing.
Yes, which that I would say definitely do your research with certain things, because I know, for instance, there's one testing called, it's like an amniocentesis, and basically they put a needle in your belly to remove some of the amniotic fluid to test it to see if you have any chromosomal defects, so anything like Down syndrome, or there are a few others, but I don't remember all the names. But basically, I had one doctor urging me to get this test done, and there's a 1% chance of miscarriage, which I know is pretty low, but I still was like, well, I'm going to look into this. And I looked into it, and then I talked to the second doctor, and he goes, why would you have that test done? You don't need to have that test done. He said, you have like a 0.02% chance of having a child with a chromosomal abnormality. And I'm like, why is this other doctor pushing me to do this when there's a risk of miscarriage and I don't even have a very high chance of having another child with, you know, extra medical needs, you know? So it was just one of those things that I could feel a lot of pressure to get certain things done that seemed really unnecessary. So definitely if they mention doing an amniocentesis, look into it and make sure that it's necessary first.
Absolutely. And how has watching her reach different milestones at a different pace than Elliot, like how has that impacted you overall, would you say?
I think it's initiated a lot of grief all over again, because I had spent majority of the first year of my son's life beating myself up for him not doing certain things, because I felt like, well, I need to be doing more exercises with him, or I need to do more therapies with him, or I need to do more interventions. And like, I kept thinking that it was my fault that he wasn't doing certain things. But then my daughter, she's not getting nearly as much energy from me, simply because when you have that second child, you know, it's harder to juggle two kids. So, but she's doing way more things. And there's some things she's doing I haven't even taught her. I've not even sat down and worked with her, and she just does them. So it was very eye-opening to me, because it made me realize that we had a very hard first child. And it's interesting, because even our doctor, like, his pediatrician has a child with Down syndrome. So he knows the struggle, and he knows things that are hard. And he said, my child is the youngest with Down syndrome. We already had three other kids. He said, you have the hard child first, you know? And he said, it's okay to be stressed about it. It's okay to grieve it, but it's not your fault. And I remember him telling me that, and I just like cried, because the whole time I'd been feeling like it was my fault. And it's just one of those things that you can't help it. You can't help it if your child isn't meeting certain milestones. And a lot of kids just do things. They have that motivation to do it. And I've seen my daughter, like, she just wants to do stuff. And Elliot has no motivation to do certain things. He just doesn't want to do it. And so it's just a different, you know, a combination of personalities, but also the difference between he has a disability and she doesn't, you know. So I think it's one of those things where I've just had to grieve all over again, but it's also given me reassurance that I'm not a bad parent. I just have two different kids.
Exactly. And what would you say, like, your biggest advice to other moms in similar situations would be?
I would say, don't go to Google first. That's probably the worst thing to do, because it doesn't give you any personal information. It just right away, it like assaults your senses with all the negatives. So I'd say that's the first bit of advice. But the other bit of advice would just be to understand that it's not your fault for a lot of things. There will be certain times when you do mess up as a parent, and there will be times that you maybe you could have done more, or maybe you could have helped more, or maybe you could have, you know, but at the same time, especially when you have a child with a disability, there's going to be a lot of things that they may never do, and that's okay. So I feel like I needed to hear that when I first had Elliot, because it felt like, did I, you know, eat something wrong in my pregnancy, or did I take too much like pain reliever, or did I not exercise enough? And is that why my child has Down syndrome? And really, it's random. There's no rhyme or reason for it. And I think, you know, obviously at a God level, God knows why those things happen. But ultimately, like, I've seen so many moms get on these kids with disabilities like Facebook pages, and they're like, I heard that if you had too much Tylenol, that's what causes, you know, this disability, or that's what causes this. And I'm like, don't do that to yourself. It's not going to help you to blame yourself and be like, well, I took three Tylenol and that's why. It's not going to help. And so, like, I've just stopped looking for that kind of stuff, because it does not help you be the mom that you need to be in the moment. And there's no actual scientific evidence that anything causes Down syndrome. So that's what I would say.
I think that's really good advice. I think that can apply really to anything too, because, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And so you can't beat yourself up for not knowing something, like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have taken all of this medication because now I've got a problem with my liver, or whatever it may be. Like, there's always going to be things that you're going to do. And until you know, that have the knowledge, or you take certain tests, the doctors, or something comes up, you're not going to know that you shouldn't have done X, Y, and Z. And so I think that it's good to reflect on what we've done, what we've said, so that we can become better people, but not to the point where we stop living.
Yes. Well, and that's what I've been going through that a lot harder recently with my son's autism diagnosis, because we thought, you know, he was diagnosed with Down syndrome. And we thought that was, you know, that was the diagnosis. But then once he got diagnosed with autism, it was just a whole new, what did I do? Like, is it my fault? You know, and I think it's a lot worse in the autism community. There's so many more people who say, well, this was your fault as a parent. And I just don't listen to those people because it's not helpful. It's not edifying. And that's not the voice of God. God does not accuse. God kindly, you know, puts us in the right direction and kindly rebukes, but he does not get in our head and tell us like, well, that's your fault and you're just a screw up as a parent. You know, that's not the voice of God. So don't listen to it.
I think that that is one thing that is so much easier said than done, but also really important to remember that we choose ultimately what we listen to, whether it be other people, whether it be ourselves, whether it be certain music, TV, whatever. And we choose what we are allowing to stick to a point. And so I think it's important to fill our minds and our thoughts with things that are true versus things that aren't.
And that was the main thing that really like sticks in my mind. And I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget. But like, there's that passage in the Bible. It's like John 9:1-3, where they see a man who's born blind. And it says, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. And every time I read that, it's always like, I always put in there, who was it that sinned, his parents or him? And I think it wasn't me that sinned. It wasn't my sin that caused Elliot to have a disability. It's so that God's glory may be reflected through him and through our family. And that always just like, it wrecks me emotionally. I'm just like, every time I read that.
I really appreciate you sharing that. I think that that is something, regardless of whether the listeners are Christians, I think that that's something that is important to know, that it's not their doing, it's not their fault, and it's also not their kids' fault either.
Yeah.
In what would you say some of the biggest struggles, I know that we've talked about some of it, but raising a kid with special needs is, and what would you say some of the biggest blessings that you wouldn't have necessarily expected have come from it?
I'll start with some of the struggles, but like, I think the hardest part has been, my son was born at the same time as a lot of other kids. So he has a lot of kids his age. So we have a direct, a front row seat to where a child is, quote, you know, supposed to be at this age. And it's really hard to like go to the birthday parties or go to church or, you know, anything where we're in those communities, and to see like, that these kids are so much further ahead of where he's at, because at home it's easy to, you know, forget that, you know, you're at home and it's like, well, he's just Elliot and, you know, that's just how he is. But then when you like have direct comparisons, it's hard to not play the comparison game. And I think a lot of that is tough because you have certain milestones or certain things that kids are doing all at the same time. And, so that is a struggle. I think for me, that's the hardest part, because I'm continually grieving that, or when he gets unintentionally left out. Thankfully, we've been in a community where he gets invited to pretty much every birthday party, and that's lovely. It's great. But it's still very hard sometimes to feel like he gets unintentionally left out, but he leaves himself out. You know, he doesn't talk to other kids. He doesn't play with other kids. And you know, kids aren't going to know to go over by him and be like, you know, make him play with them. So I think that that's definitely the challenging part. But on the flip side of it, one of the things, like, I'm a writer through and through. Like, I love communicating with my words. And I always struggled growing up when I couldn't communicate with somebody. Like, if somebody was nonverbal or if they spoke another language than I did, I always felt so insecure. And then I realized when I had Elliot and he's nonverbal right now, God is teaching me another way of communication. And that just, it blew my mind. Cause it was kind of like, God always, like, he takes our talents and abilities and then he takes us deeper. And I feel like that's what's been happening. God's been challenging me to learn another way of communication. And so it's been so exciting to get excited when Elliot's able to do certain things. Like, for instance, he's recently been grabbing my hand and he'll lead me to where he wants something. Like, he'll lead me to the kitchen if he's hungry, or he'll lead me to the TV if he wants to watch his show, or he'll sit me down and climb in my lap if he just wants me to hold him. And it's just made me really emotional because I'm like, he is communicating with me and he is connecting with me in the way that he knows how. And now I know how to speak to other people that are like Elliot when I didn't know how to do that before. And so I feel very blessed that God saw fit to like really humble me, because I had so much pride and I didn't realize it. And so it was just amazing to see that God was like, nope, I'm not going to keep you in that spot. I'm going to make you realize that there are people that you are not impacting because you have so much pride about speaking and the like verbal, you know, verbalizing. So I don't know. That's been really cool to see with having a child with a disability. I feel like it's given me a new way to really minister to other people.
That's so awesome. I love that. And is there anything that I haven't asked or commented on that you would like to add?
I think the main thing is just don't be afraid to ask questions. You know, with people who have kids with disabilities, majority of the time, we are not as easily offended as people would think. I've had some really good conversations with people who just ask straight up questions like, why does his tongue hang out of his mouth? Or why is he smaller than other kids? Or why, you know, and a lot of these questions have been from other kids. And I appreciate the directness because I know that they're not meaning it in a rude way. They just want to know, they want to understand. And so if you go into it wanting to understand, that's the biggest thing. Because we can see the heart of that. We can understand that, like, you don't have to be afraid if your kid goes, hey, mommy, what's that kid doing? You don't have to be afraid. You can come over, you can be like, hey, my son has never seen anyone like your son before. Could you tell us a little bit about it? And how can we be a blessing to you? Like, how can we, you know, and that's okay. I'm okay if people are direct with me. So I would say, just for your listeners, if they're ever in a situation where they're like, I don't know what to do, I'm really stressed, like, I want to minister to this person, but I don't know how, that's the best way, is just ask questions.
That's awesome advice. And obviously, there may be some people that aren't accepting of that, but that's not necessarily, you know, if you're going into it with a good intention, it's not your responsibility for their reaction.
Yes.
And I know that you've mentioned a little bit about writing. So switching gears a tiny bit, can you tell us about your upcoming book?
Yes. So it's definitely a departure from disability. And I mean, I guess not totally a departure, but because I do have, there is a character that has a disability in the story. So I'm not going to spoil it, but so basically, since I was 9, I've been writing stories, and I typically like writing fantasy and sci-fi. And so about, I think it's been 10 years now, I had an idea for a story that didn't go anywhere. And then when I had Elliot, it really inspired me to just be like, you know what? I'm going to publish the book. Like, it's going to get done. So since he was born, I've been just kind of working away at this book. And it's called Consigned to Oblivion, and it's a Christian sci-fi book. But it's supposed to be published hopefully in July of this year. So that's the plan, is July of 2024. But basically, I'm just going through the self-publishing process and trying to get it out into the world. But currently, it's with my professional editor, and she's looking over it for me to make sure that it doesn't have any typos and stuff. But it's definitely been something I've been working on for a long time, and something that I'm excited about because it delves into mental health and people from different religious backgrounds, and of course that sci-fi otherworldly element to it, because I love stories that have that in it. So
that is so exciting. I'm so happy for you. And to the listeners, when the book is out and she lets me know and gets me a link and all of that, it will be under on the Beautiful _ Legacy Instagram. There is a highlight with guest links. And so the link will be there. And I don't know, with the changes being made to this platform, if I'll be able to edit the description and put it in the description of this episode. But if you do not see it there by the end of 2024, definitely go check out the guest link highlight on the Instagram. And I know that you also have a podcast, so could you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Well, yes, me and my mom both have a podcast, which it's funny because our voices are so similar. So if you do pop onto the podcast, you'll be like, who is talking? But we do have an Instagram.
Even being your friend and talking to you all the time, I still got confused.
Well, we have like the same laugh and everything, but we have started doing like videos on our Instagram too. So like, if you're ever struggling, you can go and like look at the videos. But it's called the Born Again Broadcast. And we started out doing kind of like talking about motherhood and talking about politics and like current events and stuff. But we've really transitioned into reviewing books and talking about theology. Because I really enjoy reading fiction books, and my mom really enjoys delving into theology. So we really just talk about both. But yeah, if you want to, our Instagram is the Born Again Broadcast, and we're hopefully going to start back up soon. When I had my second baby, we took a long hiatus because it was really hard to get back into it. So, but hopefully we're planning to start in the next few weeks and get back into it.
That's awesome. And besides on Instagram, what platforms is it available on?
So we also do our podcast through like Anchor FM. So it should be on Apple Podcasts, Google. I believe it's on Spotify. And then of course on the Anchor FM website. And then we do share some on Facebook as well. But I don't think we have like an official Born Again Broadcast Facebook. I think I've just been sharing it through my personal Facebook. So you may not be able to find us on there, but those are the places where we typically share.
That's awesome. And was there any last things about any of the topics that we've talked about that you wanted to add before we wrap this up?
I think those are the main things. I don't feel like you missed anything. You asked a lot of good questions. So
awesome. And so for social media, I know we kind of just touched on that, but where can people find you?
Typically the best place to find me is on Instagram. So I'm under Emily Brianne Ward, which I guess they'll see how my name is spelled on your description of this episode, but my name is spelled differently. So I don't know if I need to give the spelling.
The first name will be on there, but the middle name won't. I can't remember. Do you spell the middle name different too?
I think so. So let me, it's Emily. So it'd be Emilee. And then Brianne would be Brianne. And then Ward, which is just Ward.
Awesome. And with the podcast being called Beautiful Legacy, I like to ask all my guests, what kind of legacy do you want to leave and why?
I think the main thing would just be a legacy of warmth and acceptance. I want people to always feel like when they're in my house or they're with me that they're loved and they are respected, even if we come from different backgrounds. I always want people to feel like they're understood. And because that's one thing that I feel like I didn't have as much growing up. So I want my legacy to go forward and for people to feel like they are part of the family group and then they have a seat at my table always.
I absolutely love that. I feel like you're doing a great job at that, even through Marco Polo, because that's really how we communicate because we're states apart. So I would say that you're doing a great job at that. But besides being an awesome friend, how are you making that happen?
Mostly just trying to take every day and think of it as an opportunity for meeting people where they're at. So like usually I try to every doctor's appointment I go to or every church service or grocery store, I try to be people around me. Most of the time my husband he's always busy at church volunteering. So usually I don't have a place that I sit. So I kind of float. I try to sit with new people every day. So that's kind of one of those things where I'm constantly trying to make sure that I'm not being exclusive, but I'm being inclusive and looking like my face is open and ready for a conversation rather than being in my phone, you know?
That's super awesome. I love that. And I really appreciate you giving me and the listeners some of your time today. And to the listeners, as always, you are loved, you are worth it, you are priceless, and I will talk to you all later.